Today's Teisho is entitled, today's Teisho is on case 20 in the Mumon Kwan, the Umen Kwan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 20 is entitled, The Man of Great Strength. Shogen Osho said, why is it that a person of great strength does not lift his legs? And he also said, it is not the tongue he speaks with. Mumon's comment, it can be said that Shogen shows us all his stomach and intestines, but alas, no one can appreciate him. And even if someone could appreciate him, let him come to me and I'll beat him severely. Why? If you want to find pure gold, you must see it through fire. Mumon's verse, lifting his leg, he kicks up the scented ocean. Lowering his head, he looks down on the fourth dhyana heaven. There is no space vast enough for his body. Now, somebody write the last line here. So this is the third day of our January 2009 Sesshin, and record cold temperatures, I understand. So it's very cold. We've had actually colder Sesshins than this, but this is pretty cold. And I'm so glad that the bunkhouses are separate from this building. Because we have to, you know, even if you want to take a pee, you have to go outside in that very cold weather, just long enough to get to the dormitories, you know. And something about it, you might sit here thinking, do I really need to take a pee? You know, it's so cold, you know. But then you think, yes, I do. And you know, not everybody can line up for the single bathroom there, you know, or the two bathrooms. So somebody's got to go back to the dorms and take a pee, you know. So, you know, then you go out there and when it's this cold, you know, it's a bit of a shock, you know. And then you get to the door and you get in and say, ooh, you know. But there's something about that experience, I think, which is exciting. You know, it's actually exciting. And we work so hard to protect ourselves from that experience. And when it's happening, you know, nobody who's walking in 9-degree weather outside in maybe just a cotton shirt is totally comfortable, you know. And it is a good thing that there's a dorm on the other end, right? You're not just stuck out there overnight, you know. And it's a good thing that bathrooms are heated. You know, in fact, that bathroom is deliciously warm, right? You know. So you know, that's good. But there's something about that interval, you know, where if you've been doing some zazen, I think, and you're walking outside and you're going to the dormitory, and the cold hits your face, it can be absolutely thrilling, you know. Why is that? You know, there's something about an experience like that which we try so hard to avoid, but when it happens in the right way, it can be really enormously exciting. You know, I was so happy this morning by the practice that went on in this room. We have, you know, I think the morning sits are really something special. You know, we have 3 half-hour sits in a row, and we don't do any kinhin. And it's a real challenge, you know. But the morning sits are so beautiful, I think. You know, you're sitting there and the sun is coming up. And often it's rather still, you know, early in the morning. And you're starting the day in deep samadhi, in deep mushin. This is a beautiful way to start the day. And really deep, you know. I mean, people who start sitting with our group usually come on a Monday or Friday night. And they often, you know, have a hard time getting through two sits in a row. You know, when it gets to be about 25 minutes, I can see some people squirming on the cushion. And I mean, I certainly started that way, you know. But eventually, people get to the point where they can do a half-hour sit and then have walking meditation and then another half-hour sit. You know, they think, well, maybe I'll give the Thursday sit a try. And then they go to the Thursday sit, and there's no walking meditation. It's like 25 minutes or 30 minutes, 25 minutes or 30 minutes, 25 minutes or 30 minutes, you know. You know, generally speaking, people who go to the Thursday sit eventually prefer it, you know. Even though they may come to the other sits for convenience, there's something special about that Thursday night sit. When you're really in deep concentration, you don't necessarily want to get up and walk around the hallway. You're in this beautiful state, and you don't want to interrupt it. And it's physically challenging not to move for three sits, you know. But there's something that happens. Maybe it's a little bit like what happens to us when we're going out the door into the dormitory and it's 9 degrees out. There's something about that experience which is a little bit unnerving, you know, maybe a little bit disturbing sometimes, but there's something tremendously energizing about it too, I think. And so, you know, this morning we had our three sits in 9 degree weather, and everybody sat so beautifully. Everybody made such a beautiful effort. In the third sit, you know, I look around the zendo, and of course I see people like Yen, who, you know, doesn't move, you know, three sits, you know, it's just stunning, you know, and then you know, other people too, sitting so still, and not moving. And some people sitting through the bell, you know, and it's just really deeply inspiring to me. It's really something about that, isn't it odd? You know, there's a part of us that says, "Move, move, move, move." And by the way, you know, if you're in pain, Zen is not about about being in agony. It's not about, you know, being in agony. So if you're in pain, you know, by all means, you know, if you're sitting there and you're just, your teeth are chattering, you know, just stop and uncross your legs and very quietly so you don't disturb other people. And then, you know, get a little breather, and when you're ready, you know, put your legs back into position and go on, you know. But at some point it will be possible, you know, to go through sit one, and then maybe think, well, you know, I don't want to move. And it's a little scary, you know, when you do this, because it's a little bit, you know, you think, can I get through the next sit? You know, can I make it through the next sit? And, you know, sometimes you don't. You think, okay, it's like going across a high wire. You know, you think, can I get to the other side, you know, without falling off? And sometimes you fall off, you know. But fortunately, you're just on a mat, so you can't be hurt, you know. If you fall off a high wire, that's over, right? So basically, it's a little bit risky, right? But it's not that risky. And you give it a try, you make it through, and get to the other side, and you think, wow, I did it. And there's, it's not just the sense of accomplishment, right? I mean, when you're in deep samadhi, you know, sometimes like it's like we say dropping body and mind. You know, sometimes it's like you drop the body and you drop the mind. You're in a kind of state of no. Sometimes you're in this state where there's no thought for a few seconds at a time, or where there's, the thoughts are very marginal. They're out there somewhere, but you're not with them. And the mind can be blank and dark, and parts of your body can be absent. So you don't have normal body sensation, right? People have different experiences of this. You might feel empty, you might feel like there's a hole opening up in the center of you. You might feel like your hands are upside down, or, you know, there's many different ways to experience this state, but somehow in this state it's very elating. You know, it's like, I feel so good, you know, I feel so good. It doesn't always happen, I understand, but when it happens, boy, is it sweet. And you can't make it happen. You know, you can't make it happen. You can sit down and say, I want that sweet sit, you know, and not today, you know, or not this time, you know. But when it happens, it's so sweet. And it's like having heavy weights taken off your shoulders, I think, you know. We carry around a lot of baggage in our lives. We carry around a lot of baggage. We've been piling it on ourselves for many years, you know, and you know, basically, it's baggage in our minds and baggage on our bodies, and when you can, you know, sit down on the cushion and you know, drop body and mind, it's like flying. It's just, oh my God, that's so free, it's so beautiful, such a beautiful experience. So maybe that happened to you this morning, but it will if you keep practicing sooner or later. Now I know that every sit isn't like that. It's not like that. You know, I actually have many sits like that. You know, but not all of them. You know, and there's some sits where I'm really, it's like I'm dragging a big a bag of iron across the ground. You know, it's not so easy, right? And I know also that, you know, physical challenges can be quite significant, you know. Some people are just like engaged in a struggle with the pain. It's like a raw struggle with pain. And I just want to say that you're engaged in something that's very, you're doing something that's absolutely crucial. Dealing with pain is absolutely crucial. You know, pain is quite central to human existence. And people don't like to think about pain. And they don't like to think about the role pain plays in their lives, because, of course, it's painful. Right? Pain hurts, and people pretend try to contain pain, and they try to pretend it doesn't exist. You know, if you go to the store, there's numerous painkillers, and I'm glad those painkillers exist. You know, and we design furniture to be, you know, very comfortable and so on, and that's great, you know. In some ways our culture is afraid of death, basically. We don't like to have dead things around, we don't like to think about death too much, and in the way we deal with dead bodies and things, it's very clear we want to get them out of sight and out of mind. And I think it's the same thing with pain, you know. But pain is such an elemental aspect of existence that if we live in denial of pain, we don't see how it influences us. you know. And you can understand why people don't want to think about pain, but it's an incredibly powerful human motivation. Basically, the other day I was reading something about a baby being born, and I realized, holy smokes, you know, that must be an incredibly painful experience. It's painful often for the mother, but it occurred to me, it's probably a really painful experience for the baby, you know. Now, you know, when we talk about being born, of course it's a wonderful event, right? It's like, oh, this is so beautiful to come into the world and so on. But, you know, actually physically it must be really murder, you know. I mean, really hard, you know. I mean, think about it. Think about, you know, you get squished, you know. You're in this your environment, and all of a sudden it's gone. Then you're squished, and it hurts. It's like, you know, imagine if, you know, you were pushed hard on all sides, you know, and until you felt like your bones were going to break, and they're so pliable, they don't break. And maybe your skull gets a little deformed by, you know, the process, you know. You finally come out and it's freezing cold, you know. And, you know, it's the whole thing actually entails quite a bit of, you know, it's stressful, you know. And it probably hurts, you know. All through life there's like this undercurrent of pain, and people are really terrified of pain. And if you think about it, many of the terrible things that people do are motivated by fear of pain. So, you know, when somebody kills somebody else, you know, you could think, why do they do that, you know? But often behind it, there's like the motive is actually to avoid pain. You know, murder is often, the root of murder is often like trying to avoid some kind of pain. It could be public exposure, you know, it could be physical, you know, privation. You want something that you can't have, you know. All of those are forms of discomfort or suffering. So, you know, there's something so elemental about Zen practice, because, you know, we could have a very different kind of environment here, you know. We could get up at 7:30, you know, we'll convene for breakfast at 8, you know, and then we'd get in a circle and we'd share, you know. You know. And then we can have workshops, you know, working, you know, loving your koan, you know, the challenge of the koan, right? And we have a talk too, a very interesting talk on emptiness. And we could do it like that, right? There's a kind of you know, there's a place for that. I'm not, you know, I'm obviously making fun of it, there's a place for that. But you know, it's like dancing around the elephant in the room, right? It's like dancing around the elephant in the room. And pain is like the elephant in the room, right? That nobody wants to deal with. So Zen, you know, puts the elephant right in the room and then has the elephant sit on you, you know? So Zen basically says, you know, here you're going to have to deal with this, you know, and you sit on the cushion and you feel pain, and naturally you don't want to be in pain, right? This is so important. It's so important not to run from pain, because if you run from pain, you'll never stop running. And you know, there's many different kinds of pain. You know, there's the kind of pain that would make us not want to stand up to a bully when we're little kids, because he's going to punch us, right? And now it's really going to hurt, you know. And then, you know, if you're like me, when I was a little kid, after you get punched, you start crying, and then everybody sees you crying, and there's the pain of public humiliation and stuff like that. But you know, on a deeper level, people can't really necessarily encounter the truth or face the truth because they're too afraid of the pain. You know, there's a habit, a deep habit of like evading the truth. You know, really, I mean, people are deeply evasive of the facts. And they just don't want to face them because they're painful, right? So people would often rather have like a beautiful deception, you know, rather than facing hard truths. And this is quite, you know, widespread, you know, it's quite widespread. So if you're like pain averse, if you're afraid of pain, you know, I think you're easy to manipulate, and you're eagerly grasping at all kinds of illusions, anything to put between yourself and your pain. Buddhism is, you know, the first teachings of the Buddha were, you know, basically life is, you know, if you're going to be alive, it's going to entail suffering. So you're going to entail suffering. And that's, that seems so, you know, he didn't say, let me talk about bliss. He didn't say, you know, let me talk about enlightenment. He said, first thing we need to talk about is the reality of suffering. You know, when you come to Zen practice and you sit on the cushion for 8 or 9 hours a day, you have some times where you're suffering, right? And it cuts through all the, I mean, it forces you to get rid of a lot of illusions after a while, you know, because when you're sitting in pain, you can't, you know, you can't bullshit yourself, you know. You can't say, all right, I'm in pain, but I'm going to focus my mind on, like, beautiful thoughts, right? I'm going to think about Hawaii, I'm going to think about the sun, you know, because the pain just eats that up, right? You're right back on the darn cushion, and your knees are hurting you, you know? So this is like an elemental situation. Pain can take a million different forms, but this is like a very crude form, and it's really challenging you. Now, let me just say that if you put your pain in perspective, if you had like a thermometer of pain, the pain in your legs isn't that great. Even though it might, somebody came into Dokusan once and said, "I feel like my legs are being torn out of their sockets." Right? You know, and indeed that is somehow how it feels. But you know, let's put it into perspective. All we're really doing is a stretching exercise, really. I mean, that's the truth, right? I mean, it's got other dimensions, but with our legs, we're just, you know, this is like a yoga. This is like we're doing a stretch, right? Only we're doing it for 10 hours. Now the thing is, you know, this posture has many important elements. The seated meditation, the body has, the nervous system is quite complex. And when we sit on the cushion, we're stimulating nerves, other nerves are being deactivated. We're processing information differently, so the whole body is being used as like an information processor. But one element of this involves, you know, the stretching of the legs. And so, you know, the pain in your legs is very simple. It's just, it's really basically lactic acid building up in your muscle tissue, just like if you were running, right? You know, people get pain in their knees. I used to be on the swimming team, and people would get these, they're called shin splints. And your muscles in your side go into spasms because of lactic acid, and it really hurts a lot, you know. And you know, you're supposed to swim through it. The coach will go, swim through it, you know. I don't know if that really works. But the point is, you know, even though it might seem very dramatic, it's not. You know, it's just lactic acid in your muscles, and you won't be crippled for life or something like that. It won't happen, you know. This sounds like a slightly sadistic comparison, so please forgive me. But If somebody came along while you were sitting and put a lighted cigarette on your hand, let's say, you know, you would suddenly go, oh my God, you know, now that's pain, right? In other words, if somebody burned your hand, you it would put things into perspective. You'd forget all about the pain in your legs, and you realize, now that's pain. In fact, one time at a sesshin, Genki Roshi announced that he was leaving the sesshin because he had a toothache and he had to go to the dentist. And a lot of us were stunned. You know, it's like we thought, you know, you could handle any pain. And he said, oh, wait a minute. He said, this is a toothache. This is real pain. You know? And so he left and he had his dental work and he came back. Well, he could have toughed it out, I guess. But the point is, actually, that, you know, if you've ever broken your arm or something, now that's pain, you know. This pain seems so great because, you know, basically, there aren't a lot of other inputs, right? So, you know, you can't distract yourself. You've got your breath and you've got your pain, right? And so, you know, basically, you focus on the breath, but the pain is very compelling. It's present, it's very forceful, and so it's easy to become like obsessively interested in your pain. And it's just because there aren't any other inputs. It magnifies it enormously. So, you know, remind yourself that, first of all, again, the purpose of Zen is not to be in pain. This is not about, you know, toughing it out. You need to practice in a style that's natural, you know, that feels natural. If you decide you're going to train for a marathon, and the first time you run, you do 10 miles, you'll never run again, you know. You need to, you know, do half a mile, and then a mile, and then a mile and a half. You build up to the marathon by little steps, you know. So you know, we're doing the same thing with confronting our pain. There's no shame in moving if you're in agony. But, you know, when you experience your pain, do put it into perspective. It's just stretching your muscles. And it feels so overwhelming sometimes because there's nothing else to think about. Except for your breath or your mu or your koan. And you need to use those things to push through your pain. So, you know, when you feel intense pain, squeeze your hara, your dantian, and the breath goes out, and as you squeeze out, it sweeps the pain away and the mind becomes still for a second, and then the pain returns and you do it again, and the mind becomes still, and you do it again, and this, you know, and you may find after a certain amount of time you run out of mental energy. You just can't keep doing this. You can't keep sweeping the pain, and you just sort of crash, you know, and that's okay, you know. Just if you quietly adjust your posture, you know, you can sit in a chair, that's all right. Get your mental bearings back, and then when you're ready, sit down and you know, if you can get through 10 minutes without moving, excellent. And then, you know, maybe the next time you can get through 12 minutes, you know. Use your breath. Little by little, you develop mental stamina. You know, if you're just a beginner and you're looking at some of the people in the room who don't move for 2 hours, for, you know, 2 hours or an hour and a half, don't compare yourself to those people because they've been practicing diligently for years and years and years, you know. So just take, you know, you want your personal best, right? That's what you should be shooting for. And there's nothing wrong with sitting in a chair. You know, nobody's going to think, ha ha, you're sitting in the chair, eh? You know, because everybody here has been in the chair almost. You know, pretty much everybody's been in the chair at one time or another. you know, when they were starting out. So don't be such a harsh judge of yourself, you know. The interesting thing happens, you know. And let me also say that, you know, anything you're experiencing in the way of difficulty, I've experienced, I promise you. I mean, when I would watch Genki Roshi sit, it was so effortless, you know. He was the most amazing sitter I'd ever seen. I mean, he could sit for I don't know how long, you know. He would come in, you know, even today, you know, I adjust my posture, and so on. And Genki Roshi would come in, he'd sit down, and then he wouldn't move for like 3 hours or something, you know. And then he'd get up, and it's like he'd go into the kitchen to see how the udon was going, you know. He was an amazing sitter. And I was so, one time during a Taisho, he actually talked about how much he suffered as a young monk. And he once said that he was at a sesshin once where, I should say that Genki Roshi was a war orphan. He was raised by a famous Zen master named Yamamoto Genpo Roshi. And Genpo Roshi was a good Roshi, but he wasn't a good father. He didn't really know how to raise children. And when Genki Roshi was about 12, he had to do sesshin. So he was like this little monk. So you can imagine, can you imagine doing this when you were 12? You know? It's very impressive that Masae does such a wonderful job. I never cease to be amazed. I'm very impressed by people who are so young who can do Zen. But Genki didn't, Masae chose to be here, right? Genki didn't have a choice. He was in the Zendo. And he was going through the regular monastic training at 12. And he said that he would sit there on the cushion and he would just pray for an earthquake. You know, there's a lot of earthquakes in Japan. You know? So he would just be sitting there thinking, please, you know. I mean, he was so desperate, really. Can you imagine being that desperate, you know, just like, please, earthquake, earthquake. And he just thought the best thing that could happen was an earthquake and the building would just fall down and crush it, you know. They'd be out of his pain. So hearing that was very instructive, right? Because even Genki Roshi, you know, but the interesting thing was he said that sesshin, he was in that situation, and he was absolutely in utter agony, right? And he said he got up to go to the bathroom. He got up to go to the bathroom, and he went into the temple bathroom. And next to the place where you pee, next to they don't have toilets. There's like a hole. There's a little altar in the bathroom, because of course everything is our sacred body, you know. There was a Buddha on the altar and some flowers. And when Genki Roshi looked at the flowers, he said, he didn't really understand what was happening to him, but the tears just started pouring down his face, and it was like he became the flowers. You know, Genki disappeared, and he just became 100% flowers. And that was his first, we say, kensho, first opening up experience. So something happens, you know. When you go to the limits, you know, there's a boundary between ourself and the world, and we preserve it in all kinds of ways. And one of the ways we preserve it is by trying to not deal with pain, you know. But sometimes we go to the boundary, you know, the place that this is my boundary, this is my limit, this is my. We go to that boundary and then we cross it, you know, and it's always difficult to break through a barrier. It's always difficult, you know. But when we do, you know, something wonderful can happen. You know, something wonderful can happen. It's like, When body and mind drop away, everything comes alive all around you. You know, and the world comes alive in the most powerful way. This is why, you know, this is personally, this is why I've been doing Zen for so many years, since 1976, you know, so what would that be? That would be 33 years, right? I too have pain in my legs. I mean, I have many more strategies for dealing with the pain. I have deep samadhi, I can really push with my hara and so on. But, you know, it's a challenge for me too. But, you know, then you sit and you're in pain and you're in pain and you're in pain, and then all of a sudden, boom, you know, you hear the wind, or you just suddenly feel this rush of joy and energy. And you think, where's that coming from? You know, but it's because you're encountering the world in a deeper way. And so Zen is all about going through these barriers over and over again. You know, and again, it's not easy, especially at first. But the more you go through them, the easier it is, the less fearful you become. I mean, a lot of the problems with pain are the fear of pain. It's very much a mind game. You know, I mean, of course pain is difficult, you know. But a lot of it is, and it's just the lactic acid. That's real, that's not a mind game. But how we respond to the pain is a mind game. You know, we can let it, you know, sort of like, you can let it like make you collapse. You know, it says that you just collapse in the presence of this discomfort. And many people are like that, you know. Many people are like that. Yeah. But if you keep doing Zen, you know, your pain is going to defeat you many times. And that's okay, you know. It's not a shame, you know. I myself have, you know, in my Zen 33 years of Zen, I've had many sits where I just think I'm not going to make it through the sit, and I uncross my legs. You know, especially at first, I would have sits like that, you know. You don't always manage to work through the situation, you know. Sometimes things get the better of you. But if that happens, you know, it really affects you, because after a while you realize it's not so bad. This is not so bad. It's not so bad to be in pain. Now, many people are hypersensitive about this, you know. They're really afraid of being in pain. But it's not like an endless ocean. You know, it's actually rather shallow. You know, you can deal with it. And you know, you use your breath to sweep the pain away, or go into deep mushin, and you'll notice that you know, eventually your mind becomes very clear and fresh. You know, very clear and fresh. And you feel very free, like there's a weight off your shoulders. That will happen. That will happen to you. You know. So please have confidence in the process. And know that everybody in this room is going through what you've gone through. And of course, there's other processes too that are also challenging. I mean, physical discomfort is one thing. But, you know, basically, there's also, like, the discomfort of being stuck in your koan for years, which is a discomfort I know quite well, you know. You know, basically, you know, when you want so much to work through your koan, and you can't work through the koan, that's another kind of pain, right? I mean, I can remember working on a koan. I can't remember right now which one it was. Maybe it was the Mu Koan. Everybody else seemed to be passing this koan, and I couldn't pass it for years and years. And we went to this sesshin out on Vashon Island once. And I started to have, when I just before I woke up, I had this beautiful dream where I was looking at the wall of the Zendo, and suddenly the Buddha emerged from the wall. like this radiant Buddha figure. And I woke up thinking, this is the day I'm going to answer my koan. And you know what? I didn't answer that day. Was it like another year? I was so disappointed, you know. I felt, I don't deserve this, you know, I'm trying so hard. And this is suffering, right? Suffering. But, you know, eventually, this makes you a better person in so many different ways, right? I mean, for one thing, you know, basically, people can be so full of baloney, you know, and you know, when you encounter suffering, you realize the fragility of yourself and of others. And my feeling is that, you know, I think my own suffering on the cushion has made me more sensitive to the suffering of other people. Because, you know, I know how fragile I myself am, you know. And I appreciate the fragility of others. And I know that I don't like pain. And I try not to inflict pain. I try very hard, although I'm not always successful, not to inflict pain on other people. I think at the very least, this is, sitting does that, right? But it also, you know, when you do break through the barrier and you suddenly realize that, okay, you know, my small self is very fragile. My small self has, you know, very clear limits and so on. You get outside of that little self and you enter this deeper connected life, you know. You realize that in another sense, you know, we're kind of indestructible. There's a kind of a, you know, in this, one of the Zen koans, it says, you know, they're talking about somebody like Lin Ji, you know, somebody who sits deeply. And they said, you know, if you hit him with a stick, he wouldn't move. You know, his samadhi is so deep that if you hit him with a stick, he wouldn't even look at, turn, he's doing zazen, you come in and hit him with a stick, and he doesn't even turn to look at you because his samadhi is so deep, you know. I mean, that it sounds crazy, you know, but it's quite possible to be like undaunted in many situations. You know, somebody like Lin Ji was famous for being like, you know, imperturbable no matter what was going on. And he kept saying to people, you know, you can find, there is inside of you this indestructible energy that you can tap into. You know, that's your true nature, actually. So don't live in your little self, you know, live in this bigger self. Shogen Osho asked, why is it that a man of great strength does not lift his leg? See, I mean, if you're dealing with pain and you're using the small self, you know, you're not going to win. Pain is a much more powerful opponent. And if you're dealing with a barrier of another kind, like with your koan, you know, and you're feeling thwarted or blocked, you know, if you stay in your small self, it only makes things worse. You know, you're not going to work through the barrier in your small self. You know, you can't. You have to. We say, body and mind. You have to drop body and mind on the cushion. You have to enter that bigger mind, that bigger awareness. To do that means entering deep mushin, deep mushin. So you know, I myself have worked with koans for years trying to get through koans, you know, one particular koan for like more than a year. In fact, many years on some koans. And I went through all the emotions of, you know, I was angry at Zen, I was angry at Genki Roshi, you know, this is a scam, this is a fraud, blah, 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 you know. Eventually, you know, I realized there's something about sitting that is very beautiful, even though I don't answer my koans very often, you know. And even if I never answer my koan, I think I'm going to keep doing this because I feel so much more alive when body and mind drop. And then instead of practicing to answer koans, I was practicing to drop my body and mind on a cushion. And I began to have more success with my koans. So there's a spirit of practicing, which is, first of all, don't stay in your small self. And secondly, don't care about outcomes. Don't care about the outcome. Gain and loss, right and wrong, such thoughts must finally be abolished at once. If you spend the rest of your life working on a koan, there's nothing wrong with that. If you meet somebody who says, I've answered all the koans in the Mumonkan, that's not necessarily a great achievement. Because the purpose of doing koans isn't to answer koans. The purpose of koan training is to wake up. So these are just like expedient means, right? So practice wholeheartedly. It's like you make a gift of yourself to your practice. Practice wholeheartedly. And don't worry about the outcome. Expect nothing. Just make yourself a gift. And if you drop body and mind on the cushion, you'll begin to connect with things in the most beautiful way. And it really won't matter whether you answered your koan. Just this joy of being alive is so important. And I think this is the best way to live. Sooner or later you will answer your koan. So don't be agonized. But agonizing over it just makes it all worse, right? It makes it all worse. It's not a good psychological strategy, and it's a bad way to live. The truth is that, connecting with this bigger self is its own reward. It's worth more than any koan, So please, everybody here is practicing really wholeheartedly. It's really deeply inspiring. And the secret is, don't try to do it yourself. Use big mind. Go into mushin. And drop body and mind. Enter that blankness. Become one with your breath. Okay? And it is true, if you want to find pure gold, you must see it through fire, right? That you have to do that sometime. But it's so easy to do if you're not in your small self. And may I say, every time you think, I do it too, right? Every time I sit on the cushion and go, oh, this is so unfair, I don't deserve this, blah, blah, blah. That is the voice of your small self, right? Yeah.